Good afternoon. If you'd like to turn to 1 Kings chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19, it's also up on the board. That's where we'll be starting this afternoon. And I'd just like to start by reading in verse 1. We'll go through verse 10. Then Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take my life away, for I am no better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree, and behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of the food of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. Then he came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away." This topic was an idea presented to me by one of the members here, and I was especially intrigued by the question they posed to me about it. Are you so ready to die for Christ that you forget to live for Him? And I've entitled this lesson, "The Trap of Self-Martyrdom." And the reason I want to start here in 1 Kings 19, and the reason we're going to be spending quite a bit of time here, is because of the way Elijah acts in this situation, considering the context of what has happened. I won't read through it, but in 1 Kings chapter 18 is the famous showdown at Mount Carmel. Elijah stands opposite 450 prophets of Baal, while most of Israel, or a large crowd of Israel, as far as we are told, is assembled watching. And they all witness how God demonstrates His total power and superiority through Elijah. Fire comes from heaven and consumes a sacrifice soaked in water. And all of Israel sees the great glory and majesty of God, and that the Baal worshipers and that the false god Baal is nothing more than a sham, and they're worthless. Israel now knows and understands who reigns supreme and who they ought to worship, and then the prophets of Baal are slaughtered. This is a great victory for God's people by all accounts. An amazing example of what can be done through the faithful with God's help. And then we get here to 1 Kings 19. Jezebel, hearing of what Elijah's done, threatens him. Says, "I'm going to kill you." And Elijah is afraid. And I don't necessarily want to fault Elijah for feeling fear at this. Jezebel was an evil, wicked woman, and through her schemes and manipulation, wielded just as much, if not more, power than King Ahab in the land. It's a frightening adversary to have indeed. But the way Elijah reacts to this fear, that's what I want us to focus on, and that's what I want us to learn from. Because Elijah runs. And in verse 4, we see what I think is the first pitfall of self-victimization, of self-martyrdom. He says to the Lord in verse 4, "It is enough now, God. Take my life." It's enough. I'm done. I've done so much for you, God. I've just worked so hard. I've done all of this. And now I'm ready to go. Just take me up. I think there's a lot to unpack in this idea, but I want to start with what I think is the first issue with Elijah's reaction, and that's Elijah doesn't recognize that it's not his work, it's God's work. We see a little later in what I read in the same chapter, at the beginning of verse 10, Elijah replies to God by saying, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. I've done so much for you, God. I just did all this stuff. And now my life is threatened and I'm done. I want to be finished now. I've done the good work. I've done so much for you." Elijah forgets that he's not the one doing the real work here. Elijah has just witnessed this awesome display of God's power and superiority. And at the first sign of retribution, of persecution for it, he wants to say, "Well, this is my time. Look at how much I've done. Take me now, God." Garen recently brought a lesson, and he brought it up again this morning, about the bare minimum we can do for God. And the answer is the absolute best you can. There's no bare minimum we can get away with. And I think this is a very similar idea to that. There's no point in our lives where we get to say, "Well, I've done the good work and now I get to be, I get to be done. I get to be finished because I've hit that goal. Lord, take me now." But sometimes I think we can still fall into this trap where we almost want to make a martyr of ourselves because we've done good in the past. I've brought up Jesus to my neighbor every day I've talked to him for the past 3 months. But he's not coming to church. He's not here. So I'm finished there, God. I'm done with that. No more I can do. I've done a lot for God. I preach, I pray, I teach. But I've been having a lot of pushback recently. Some people have said mean things about me. So God, just let me be finished here. Time to call it quits. I want to read from Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13. "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." And pay attention to verse 13. "For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure." Firstly, we need to quit attributing what we do to some skill or great effort on our part. It's God's work. It's not your work. It's not what I've done. It's what God has done through us. We work for His good pleasure. And He works through us for that goal. We do the legwork. We spread the gospel. We set an example. We live righteously. But just like on Mount Carmel, the great work is done by God. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 6 through 9. Get there real quick. Should have stayed in Philippians. Would have been quicker. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 6 through 9. "I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. He who plants and he who waters are one, and each will receive his wages according to his labor. For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, God's building. He who plants and he who waters are nothing, because God gives the growth." God does the great work after we've done the legwork. Elijah on Mount Carmel, he could have hooped and hollered till he was blue in the face. But without God, that's just a dead animal on some wet logs. When you're confronted with trials in life, and you've been walking as a Christian, you've done what's right, but somebody doesn't listen to you, You encounter persecution. You encounter reproach. That doesn't mean that your work is done, that it's time to stop and put yourself on a pedestal about how much great work I've done and be finished. It means there's more great work for God to do through you. Let's turn back to 1 Kings chapter 19, and we'll pick up reading again in verse 10. He said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." I want to stop here for a second. But I can't help but laugh a little bit at what happens here. As God, again, shows Elijah His greatness. He shows Elijah His awesome power. And what does Elijah come back with? Almost the exact same statement. And what I want to pay attention to is the latter part of what he says in both verses 10 and 14. "I alone am left. It's just me. And they're seeking to kill me, God. I'm all alone here." There's a couple things wrong with what he says. But what I think the primary issue here is that Elijah is doubting God's ability to give the increase in this situation. And I think the great irony with Elijah's statement, his proclamation that he is alone, is at the end of 1 Kings chapter 18 and verses 38 and 40. We'll read that. "Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, 'The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God.' And Elijah said to them, 'Seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape.' And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishon and slaughtered them there." The great irony is Elijah had just seen how the power of God can bring people to Him. All of Israel fell to their face and said, "The Lord is God." And here we have Elijah, not a chapter later, saying, "God, I'm alone. We did some great things. I saw this great work, but I'm alone, God. It's just me." He's so quick to, again, make a martyr to himself, out of himself, when encountering difficulty. And I think sometimes, as Christians and as a congregation, this is a trap we can fall into, especially in a smaller congregation such as ours. I think, unfortunately, sometimes we can have this attitude of, well, we've talked to some people, we've done some evangelism, but we're still small. It's just us, God. There's no one else here in Taylor, Texas. We alone are left. So we're just going to have to make do with being small. We're just going to have to be content with this. Because that's it. We're just a small congregation and that's the end of it. Let's read the next several verses after verse 14 of 1 Kings chapter 19. In verse 15, "And the Lord's reply, 'And the Lord said to him, Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah you shall anoint to be a prophet in your place. And the one who escapes the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." We just read that God gives the increase. We sow and we water, but God gives the increase. And we have to have faith that God's going to give that increase. After we sow, after we do His great works and we spread His great word, we can't say, well, that's, you know, it's okay. We're going to stay small. And we've tried, but it didn't work now. So we're just going to have to make do with this. We can never use difficulty in growth as an excuse to halt what we're doing, because God will give the increase. How many times does He tell Elijah, "What are you doing? Why are you here? Why aren't you out doing more great works?" In Matthew chapter 9, verses 35 through 38, "And Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. When He saw the crowds, He had compassion for them, because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then He said to His disciples, 'The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into this harvest.'" The harvest is plentiful. There is much work to be done. And to halt that work, to say, "Well, we've tried, God. We don't have enough. There's just not enough of us. There's not enough harvest out there for us to reap." It's to not believe in God's just power to bring people's hearts to Him. We can't diminish God's ability to give the increase. We have to believe not just in His power to save, but in the power of His gospel to change people's hearts. So don't fall into that mentality of "it's just us." Because God gives the increase. Where His word is being spread and His work is being done, His people will grow. And the third thing I'd like us to focus on, and this is really the end of the account in 1 Kings chapter 19. From here, Elijah goes on. What God says will happen, happens. And he finds other believers to do and perform God's will. But what I want us to look at is something we brought up briefly at the beginning. And it's why Elijah starts to think this way. You know, Elijah saw something incredible at Mount Carmel. And he had seen, and he was going to see, so many amazing things. He is one of my favorite things to study in the Bible because of his faith and the acts that God works through him. So what happened in this moment in his life, amidst the life of such strong faith, for Elijah to do this? And the answer, I think, is in 1 Kings 19, verse 3. "And then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life." Sounds a little simple to boil it down to that. But I truly believe, based off of everything else we see about Elijah, that he innately understood the power of God. If you asked Elijah, "Do you think God can do this?" he would say yes. He knew God could do it. He had witnessed so much, but fear, in this moment, Elijah's fear caused him to doubt. He gave in to that fear and it took root in his heart. And it caused him to want to finish the race early, prematurely, to cease his work, to dwell alone, and die. It caused him to doubt God's ability to supply and to save. When we look at his statements, you can maybe think they're come from a place of pride, but I think it all comes from a place of fear. And that's the same thing that can happen with us. Sometimes we can become afraid. There is a very real fear of rejection, failure, humiliation, maybe even a fear of physical harm based on your situation. But there's always going to be something that makes us afraid. Something that makes us want to withdraw and say, I think I've done enough. You know, I'm okay being just me. I've done a lot of work, and I think I'm done for now. That fear of being the odd person out, of your word being rejected, of your teachings being rejected, of people ridiculing you, those are very real things to be afraid of. But the amazing thing about being a child of God, about being a Christian who is one a member of His body, is that we do not have to be afraid. We do not have to give in to this fear. Let's turn to Psalms 34. It's a bit of a longer reading, but I'd like to read the entirety of this psalm. Starting in verse 1. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. O magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt His name together. I sought the Lord, and He answered me, and delivered me from all of my fears. Those who look to Him are radiant. Their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear Him and delivers them. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in Him. O fear the Lord, you His saints, for those who fear Him have no lack. The young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. Come, O children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are towards the righteous, and His ear toward their cry. To face the Lord, the face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. When the righteous cry for help, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all of their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones, not one of them is broken. Affliction will slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous will be condemned. The Lord redeems the life of His servants. None of those who take refuge in Him will be condemned. We don't have to give in to fear. To be a member of God's body means we know of one who is greater than all of our fears. And we know and are part of one who can make all of those fears irrelevant and go away. And I'm always reminded of what is said in Philippians chapter 1, starting in verse 12. I'm always humbled and really in awe of the words that Paul speaks here. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but the others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come to you, come and see you, or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel, and not frightened in anything by your opponents. This is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ you should not only believe in Him, but also suffer for His sake, engaged in the same conflict that you saw I had, and now hear that I still have. In our ambition to do the Lord's will, to be Christians, we can't forget to live for Christ. We can't allow the fear of rejection or hopelessness or loneliness to cause us to stop doing the Lord's work. Because like Paul says, that's what we're here for. Our life or our death, it is for His glory. And if we stand side by side in the gospel with God, and just like verse 28 says, we will not be frightened by anything in our opponents. Don't let your fear turn you into a victim or a martyr of sin. Tonight, I know almost all of us here have been baptized. We're members of this congregation. But it's so easy to give into fear in our lives as Christians. It's so easy to say, my work is done. I'm tired. I don't want to put myself out there again and get hurt and rejected. But we can't allow fear to do that. While we draw breath, while we live on this earth, we must live for the cause of Christ. We must sow in water so that He may give the increase. If tonight you've fallen victim to these pitfalls, or if you have sin in your life which is preventing you from being a true child of Christ, from truly doing His work, then please come forward while we stand and while we sing.